Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
I just really hope, as part of this time now that we have, the committee will think about it, how we can bring innovation, how we can look at our supplemental programs that we have, that actually, bring, healthy food to the people, that we actually go into American healthy, even if we have to, and get them out of poverty and help people to have a healthy, productive life.
Victoria Spartz is a representative from Indiana. Addressing members of the House Ag Committee on Wednesday as part of Members Day.
So I would appreciate this discussion. We'll introduce some bills since we cannot do amendments now, but I hope committee will actually have a serious discussion, and I yield back.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Not only does this EV mandate display breathtaking government overreach into the auto industry, but it's also unaffordable, unattainable, and unrealistic for American consumers.
Debate on a rule in the House to prohibit EPA from finalizing, implementing, or enforcing a rule on vehicle emissions.
EVs are $13,000 more expensive than the average gas-fuel vehicle.
Michigan Representative Tim Walberg.
Repairs to an EV cost $2,300 more on average, leading to higher insurance costs, over $500 annually. The proposed standards are also unattainable. Our grid cannot handle power overload that's required. Plus, most of the country lacks the charging infrastructure needed for the mandate. We also don't have access to all the critical minerals to produce the vehicles or the capacity to refine those minerals for use in batteries. China controls most critical mineral mines, processing, and manufacturing for EVs. China has 78% of the world's cell manufacturing capacity for EV batteries. Have we already forgotten the disastrous realities of over-reliance on China for our supply chain?
At the same time, across the street in the Longworth office building, Representative Austin Scott from Georgia with Arkansas Representative Bruce Westerman.
Our forest land is extremely important to the environment. It protects our watersheds. It's our wildlife habitat. And in my state, in Georgia, thousands of acres of forest land are being cut down to put solar panels up. And land that would be worth, just as an example, approximately $5,000 an acre. The solar subsidies are so high that those companies in some cases are paying $10,000 an acre for that land. And then they clear cut it, all of it. The pines, the hardwoods, they destroy all of the wildlife habitat. And then they come in with heavy equipment and they level the land, changing the watersheds. It's a ridiculous waste of taxpayer money to give subsidies to destroy our forest land.
Yeah, well, that's an important issue, and I've got a personal story about that. I live in the same area where I grew up and close to the high school I graduated from a few years ago. I noticed that a big mature forest that was, was private land, somebody had apparently sold that. They clear cut it, and I'm talking, big pine trees like this on the side of a hill. Mm-hmm. And it was on the main road, and I thought, okay, they're putting some kind of housing development in or something. And as time passed and I would drive by, I saw them put a fence around it and start putting solar panels in. I did a little research on it, and it was a partnership with the local school to reduce their energy cost. But it was, they clear cut a mature forest, put these solar panels out, and then, to keep the weeds down, there's nothing green inside that fence. And it was all done in the name of protecting the environment and lowering the cost for the school, which the only way it lowered the cost was because there were subsidies involved.
Mm-hmm. I think this is something that I'm baffled that we can't, in a bipartisan manner, stop the destruction of the forest land with subsidies. It's not a square deal for the environment.
Yeah, if we want to put solar panels in, let's not clear-cut forests to put solar panels in.
I agree with you, and I appreciate you being here to talk about the value of our forest land to the environment and our wildlife habitat.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One of my agricultural priorities is reforming the federal crop insurance program to reduce wasteful spending and make the program work better for more farmers.
Oregon Representative Earl Blumenauer speaking on Wednesday at the House Ag Committee's Member Day.
On Monday, the GAO published a landmark report detailing how the program is failing taxpayers and producers alike. While I support a fair and well-targeted farm safety net to guarantee the security of our food system, most people would agree that giving millionaires hundreds of thousands of dollars in heavily subsidized crop insurance is neither fair nor well-targeted. Yet that's precisely what the GAO found. There are 1,341 producers making more than $900,000 a year in gross income who have two-thirds of their insurance premium paid for by the federal government. Millionaires do not need taxpayers to help them afford crop insurance, particularly when there's so many people who need to be able to take advantage of this. The numbers show this program is disproportionately skewed not towards small family farmers, but for the largest agribusiness. In fact, only one in five farmers can afford to participate in the program at all. Yet the rising federal price tag for crop insurance is not helping more producers access insurance. As proof of how consolidated the benefits of the programs are, GAO found that 1% of the policyholders receive 22% of the premium subsidies. The top 1% of property of policyholders got $464,000. This is far from risk management tool for small family farmers. In my state, 89% of the farmers receive no subsidies from the federal government. Small and mid-sized farmers around the state, the ones who actually grow the food, get very little help. For many smaller farmers and ranchers and nursery owners, especially those who grow the specialty crops, there is no suitable insurance product on the market. I hear this from the wine industry, the nursery industry. These people are shut out, and that's not fair. States like Oregon, which enjoy a diversified agricultural base, are shortchanged by the current crop insurance program. You have a very diverse agricultural base in your state, Mr. Chairman, and few people have access to crop insurance. Commodity crops accounted for 94% of crop insurance policies, whereas the whole farm revenue policies that service smaller, diversified farms, which we both represent, accounted for less than 1% of the policies sold. And that's only half the picture, because not only do taxpayers receive generously subsidized crop insurance program, they guarantee sky-high profits for private countries, many of them offshore, which administer the program. Free market advocates should be scandalized that the Department of Agriculture guarantees insurance providers a 16.8% market rate of return. You're concerned about having resources for farmers and ranchers far exceeding the 10% market-based return is a misallocation of these resources. And while the federal government is projected to spend $100 billion on crop insurance in the next decade, who is receiving these subsidies and how much they are receiving is a black box. We need more transparency, income limits, or payments caps.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
One of the key effects on purchases occurred for years ending after December 31 of 17, where trades of machinery really don't mean anything anymore.
Bob Ray is with the Illinois Farm Business Farm Management.
We have to reflect in our books and records the full purchase price of the asset, and we also have to reflect the trade-in value of the asset we're giving up. And the trade-in value is a taxable sale, even though you really receive no money for it and you don't have a deposit to take to the bank. The trade-in value is treated as a sale, but the full purchase price is available to use as a full deduction.
He also talks about changes over time.
In 2003, we only had a $100,000 179 limit, and our purchases per acre were $14 an acre. You see how those change as the 179 limit increases. And this, again, affirms that in 2021, we had $1,050,000, and now we have $1.16 million, obviously the highest value in 179 deductions we've ever had. But there is some correlation, I think, as those deduction limits rise, there is some increased purchase dollar per acre. Now, for the green sections that's shown on our slide, that was stuck at a 500,000 179 limit for several years. And because of the elongated time period of that limit, the greater impact on machinery purchases was net farm income. Here's the slide that describes our bonus depreciation changes. We, in 2003, had 50%. Then for a few years, we had no bonus available. It came back in 08 and 09 as a part of the real estate, you know, financial recovery rules. Jumped up to 100% for part of the time in 2011 and 12, a full 100%. Then back down to 50% for a while. Back up to 100% during the TCJA startup in 2018. And that's where we're at in 2022. But you see in 23, it's 80%, 24, 60%, 25, 40%, and 26, 20%, and 27, 0. Now, will these change with the next round of elections and potential legislative changes? Well, certainly possible. All we know today is what the schedule going forward looks like, but the schedule could be modified, continued, or phased out. Brad does a similar study about bonus phase outs compared to 179 and how they compared between the 179 election amounts and the bonus provisions. And you can see in 2022, 21, 20, 19, 18, we've had the largest level of both provisions ever on our books. For when I started my career in 1984, that expense election limit was $10,000, a very, very low number.
And again, with tax brackets for the year,
there are seven different income tax brackets in play for all types of filers. These numbers happen to be the break levels for those who file jointly as a married couple. The tax rates are the same for all filers on the left. It just changes for their income levels depending on your filing status as married filing separate, whether you're single or head of household. You'll have different numbers in this middle column.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The Ag Economy Barometer was up 5 points this month compared to a month earlier, and that leaves the index 13 points higher than it was this time last year, but actually 1 point lower than it was 2 years ago.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue University, and once a month, Purdue and the CME Group release their Ag Economy Barometer.
The current condition index rose 12 points compared to October, and that leaves that index up 15 points compared to November of 2022, while the future expectation index rose just 2 points compared to last month, but that leaves that index 12 points higher than it was in November of 2022. The Farm Financial Performance Index this month was up 3 points compared to October, and up 4 points compared to a year ago, but that still leaves that index 11 points lower than it was 2 years ago. When we asked farmers what their biggest concerns were for the upcoming year, they still point to high input costs as a top concern, but rising interest rates and lower crop and livestock prices are also increasingly sources of concern for farmers. The Farm Capital Investment Index was up 7 points this month compared to October, and 11 points higher than it was a year ago. When we followed up and asked producers who think it's a good time to make large investments in their farming operation, compared to last summer, fewer of them are choosing strong cash flows, and more of them are choosing higher dealer inventories as a reason for investing in their farm operation now. The long-term farmland value expectation index was down 5 points this month compared to October, but was 7 points higher than it was a year ago. The short-term index was unchanged compared to October, but it fell 4 points below its year-ago level. Producers who expect values to rise over the next 5 years continue to point to non-farm investor demand as a key source of demand for farmland.
Speaking of economy, more U.S. pork and beef plants have been approved for export to China. John Harreth has more.
U.S. beef and pork exports to China received a boost recently with new plant approvals that were a long time coming. Aaron Bohr, U.S. Meat Export Federation Vice President for Economic Analysis, has more details.
The Phase 1 agreement has many benefits for U.S. agriculture, but particularly related to plant approvals. Since the 2020 implementation of the Phase 1 agreement, China has further rolled out plant and establishment registration processes that are fairly complex and fortunately for U.S. beef and pork, Phase 1 takes precedent. USDA Food Safety Inspection Service plant approvals are still what is recognized by China. And up until about December of last year, that process was working and in place. And then this year in 2023, we hadn't seen any plant list updates. The good news is China did update the establishment lists, and that update included 12 pork establishments and 18 beef establishments, and it was a big sigh of relief that China was still recognizing the Phase 1 agreement and updating the list as put forward by FSIS. And we still expect to see further updates, hopefully still yet before the end of 2023.
While the China market is not as red hot as in years past, Bohr explains it's still a critical destination for the U.S. pork and beef industries.
There is plenty of pork in the China market, and that's kind of weighing overall. But we still see China helping to support a record year for U.S. pork variety meat exports. Our pork variety meat shipments to China this year are up 9% from last year. Shipments to China of beef so far this year are down 23%, but that still puts them as number four after Korea, Japan, and Mexico. So a huge destination for U.S. beef, and again, one that can turn quickly.
I'm John Harreth.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I'm here today to discuss my bipartisan bill with Representative Lawler, H.R. 6232, the Coordination for Soil Carbon Research and Monitoring Act.
Virginia Representative Jennifer McClellan speaking Wednesday at the House Ag Committee's Member Day.
Soil carbon sequestration refers to land management practices that promote the absorption of carbon into the soil. These practices offer clear agricultural and environmental benefits, making operations more resilient to drought, heavy rainfall, and other severe weather conditions that are exacerbated by climate change. Experts estimate that soil could store almost 5 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide worldwide each year, which equates to preventing about 13% of global annual greenhouse gas emissions from entering the atmosphere. In Virginia, some farmers are already utilizing climate-smart land management practices, increasing their cropland productivity while protecting long-term conservation. However, increased federal coordination will allow more farmers and ranchers to quickly adopt these practices in their operations. Currently, soil carbon research and monitoring efforts across the federal government are fragmented and siloed. This leads to a lack of interagency communication that prevents us from fully understanding the gaps in research and monitoring technologies for soil carbon. Moving forward, a coordinated strategy to scale soil carbon sequestration should be developed to streamline these efforts. Our bill establishes an interagency committee on soil carbon research led by the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. It directs the interagency committee to develop a cross-agency strategic plan for federal research, development, and deployment for soil carbon research, sampling, and measuring technologies. It also establishes working groups to coordinate soil carbon research priorities, including monitoring, reporting, and verification, data collection and management, fundamental research, and robust engagement with agricultural producers and communities. Finally, our bill requires regular reporting to Congress on soil carbon research and monitoring activities. I ask for your consideration of this common sense bipartisan bill and look forward to working together to advance carbon sequestration efforts. Additionally, I want to urge the committee to ensure that the next farm bill uses the almost $20 billion from the Inflation Reduction Act for its intended purposes in USDA conservation programs. Soil carbon sequestration and other climate-smart agricultural practices are a clear win-win for our farming communities and our planet.
Chairman of the House Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson.
That $20 billion from the Inflation Reduction Act has already been reduced to $16 billion by the Congressional Budget Office based on sequestration and, quite frankly, the inability of the USDA to get that money out the door by the specified time frame that's there. That's why we're talking about that. We want to see what we can preserve for investments and like on conservation more beyond 2031, well into the future, 2050, if we do it the right way.
And he also added,
and it is an incredibly important topic, and I appreciate your talking about it. But we all need to talk about how the fact that the American farmer, rancher, forester are the carbon heroes. They sequester 6.1 gigatons of carbon annually, which is 10.1% more than what they emit. So providing those tools to be able to promote really what is American agriculture and what it has been. And it's not really new. What's new is we're actually talking about it now and giving them credit for what they do. So thank you for your leadership in that area. Much appreciated.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
My colleagues and constituents and people across this country who share that faith know that we're taught in Romans that we all fall short of the glory of God, for we are all sinners.
Texas Representative Chip Roy.
That is inherently true. It is true in the United States. It is true in Great Britain. It is true in this Russia and China throughout the world. We are all sinners and fall short of the glory of God. But the thing that is unique about this country is that we've set up a system that is designed to protect us against the worst impulses of man in terms of the centralization of power in the hands of a few to be used tyrannically against the many. That is the great gift that we've inherited from our forefathers who bled, died, fought so that we could live here and live free, so that we could exercise our conscience. We could live according to the dictates of our conscience. That is why I'm thankful. That is what I was thankful for over Thanksgiving, because that is what it's supposed to be about. It's not just about the football game. It's not just about the turkey. It's not just about Friendsgiving or whatever people talk about these days. It is a specific holiday about our thankfulness as Americans and why that is so critically important to the ethos of being an American, because you aren't an American simply because of DNA or blood. You are an American because of the idea that is embodied in this chamber, in the People's House.
He lays out why he and other members of the Republican Party are frustrated with the continuing resolution.
On the Thursday before we adjourned for Thanksgiving week, after this body had passed by a suspension of the rules, that is without the normal debate process, without the regular order that was such a central part of the debates last year in this body, that we passed through suspension of the rules some $400 to $500 billion of additional spending up and through late January and early February of 2024. I found that then, and I continue to find it to be repulsive, that that is how we would conduct business. That is how we would carry out the business of the People's House. And I made clear then that I thought that it was destructive, that it was carrying on the continued policies of the previous regime passed last December over the loud objections of my colleagues on this side of the aisle to pass a $1.7 trillion omnibus spending bill chock full of leftist priorities that are destroying the American dream. Nothing short of that.
He says Americans should be furious.
Our country, our society, our culture, our people, the people we represent are in deep despair. $11,400. According to CBS News, the typical American household must spend an additional $11,434 annually just to maintain the same standard of living they enjoyed in January of 2021. That's a problem. The average American family in this country is hurting. And to watch the Democrat White House press secretary walk up to the microphone and just dismiss it and just pretend that the average American family is totally fine and can walk right out and go buy their Thanksgiving dinner and there's no harm, no foul, they're all good. The Biden administration policies, the Democrat policies, they're having no negative effect. Ignore these numbers. Ignore the cost of goods and buying food. Ignore the cost of housing. Ignore the cost of car ownership. That's what this administration wants the American people to do.
And it's part of the reason he said he will not vote for any farm bill. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, I think we have a prime act, Representative Massey has, where we actually even regulating where beef is sold within the state. I mean, that shouldn't be even, you know, the government's business, because the smaller producers of cattle producers, they actually should be able to, you know, to sell more to consumer using the state regulations. And state will do much better job being closer to the people. And we have to be much smarter in doing that.
Member Day, House Ag Committee with Indiana's Victoria Sparts.
There are a lot of things that we are having in regulatory environment that actually benefit the larger monopolies. And now we have only, you know, pretty much most of the markets on meat packing controlled by four meat packers and, you know, one from China, two from Brazil. And ultimately, they care about their own interests. And countries like China don't particularly care about American consumer, I'll be honest with you, but we have to.